If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, President Biden doubled his goal of 100 million shots in 100 days. In a few minutes, we'll hear from IPR's Natalie Krebs about how Iowa is on track to expand eligibility for the COVID vaccine. You remember, April 5th, that is the date we've been promised that all Iowans will be eligible for vaccinations. But first, let's review what's been happening at the Statehouse this week. Some of the headlines with Katarina Sestarek, IPR state government reporter. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Let's first talk about that handgun bill. A lot of interest there that was passed through the legislature, now on the governor's desk. What's happened there? Anything?
Yeah, so the Senate sent that bill to the governor's desk on Monday. And so Reynolds still hasn't said whether she will sign it into law. And what this would do is remove Iowa's current requirements to first get a permit to either purchase or carry a concealed handgun. And Republicans kind of say that, you know, federal background checks will still be required when people are purchasing guns from a licensed dealer. But the bill would take away any explicit requirement for a background check when someone's buying a gun in a private sale. So if someone's buying a gun from their neighbor, for example, and it does raise the penalty for selling a gun to someone that you should know shouldn't be allowed to have a gun. But this is something that Democrats say isn't enough and that it opens up this big loophole in our gun laws. And so some Democrats and some gun control activists are calling on Governor Kim Reynolds to veto this bill, but she just hasn't said what she'll do with it yet.
Mm-hmm. How unusual is it for this governor to wait to sign bills like this? In the past, it seems to me she does often wait to sign bills. Is this anything out of the ordinary?
It's not really out of the ordinary. There is technically a 3-day during the session. The governor technically has 3 days to sign a bill from the time that it reaches her desk. But that timing can kind of be played around with because the either the House Speaker or the Senate President can kind of when they officially sign the bill and send it to the governor, that timing can kind of be whenever they want it. But House Speaker Pat Grassley said this morning that he has signed the bill and officially sent it to the governor's desk. So it seems like she'll have about 3 days now to sign it.
Okay, we'll watch that. Another one that a lot of eyes are on is the governor's sweeping education proposal, and there's been movement on that in the legislature. Tell us about that.
The piece that moved forward this week was one that would expand charter schools. It provides another avenue for charter schools to start up in Iowa without getting approval of the local school district, which is the current requirement. And so this was a very late night debate, even went into early Thursday morning, which shout out to our colleague Grant Gerlach for staying up and covering it that late. But this is something that Republicans are saying will provide more choice for parents and students and will create competition with, you know, existing public schools and will make those schools better. But Democrats say this is something that will continue to take money away from current public school districts and that they're concerned these public charter schools wouldn't have the same transparency and accountability as current school districts.
The Iowa House also passed this week a bipartisan bill that would allow some Iowans to have nonviolent felony convictions cleared from their record. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is something that, you know, it's pretty rare that a bill proposed by a Democrat gets passed in the Republican-led legislature. And this was just one of those cases where a Democrat, Mary Wolf, she's a defense lawyer, and she proposed this bill that would allow some nonviolent felonies to be cleared from Iowans' record. So it would have to be 10 years after they've completed their sentence, and they have to have, you know, complied with everything that the court sent out, paid all their fines and fees and restitution, and then this could be cleared from their record, which, you know, can help with anything from employment to housing. And this would also allow them to get their gun rights back.
Mm-hmm. And so strong bipartisan support for this in proposed by the Democrats, I guess so.
Right. And it passed unanimously, but still not clear what will happen with that bill in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. I see in your reporting that under this bill, they would felony convictions that were expunged, these people would also regain their right to own a gun.
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the bill goes where now? To the Senate?
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about a property tax bill that has been advancing that would have some impact on funding for mental health in the state.
Yeah, so this is a very sweeping tax bill proposed by Senate Republicans, and there's been very, you know, long time discussions about finding a more sustainable way to fund mental health programs in the state. And right now, they're funded by county level property taxes. This bill would completely shift that funding to the state and creates a funding formula for how each mental health region would be funded. So there are some concerns, though, among mental health advocates that, you know, while they're happy that the legislature is discussing this issue and they do want at least some state funding in the mental health system, they think that counties should still get to retain part of the responsibility for funding it. Because, you know, if the state has a bad budget year, it's just kind of, they're just kind of promising this money and they could end up cutting mental health funding. And then this bill also, another controversial part of this bill is phasing out the backfill. And that's money that the state currently sends to local governments to make up for commercial property tax cuts. And so local governments are very against this because they're saying, you know, a few years ago, you promised that you would pay us this commercial property tax replacement money, and now you're saying you're not going to give it to us anymore. And like that could lead them to raise property taxes or cut services to make up for that loss in funding.
Mm-hmm. And give us an update, finally, before we say goodbye, Katarina, about this housing voucher bill. Remind us where we are with that, what that was about.
Yeah, so this is another bill that is on Governor Kim Reynolds' desk awaiting her signature. This would prevent cities from banning discrimination based on using a federal housing choice voucher known as Section 8. So there's three cities in Iowa right now that ban that kind of discrimination. And if this bill is signed into law, landlords would be allowed to resume that kind of discrimination in 2023.
And finally, we had a final week a couple of weeks ago, and this coming week is also a further narrowing of what may become law?
Yes, it's the second final week, so you can expect a lot of news next week out of the legislature.
Okay, glad you're covering it for us. IPR's Katarina Sestarek, our state government reporter. Until next week, Katarina, have a great weekend.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a Friday News Buzz edition of our program, Quick Conversations to End the News Week. Earlier this week, someone spray-painted racist graffiti in large yellow letters on the front of a vacant house in southeast Cedar Rapids. Members of the community quickly cleaned off the racist slur. Still, of course, a painful reminder of prejudice. Ture Morrow was one of the people who helped clean off the graffiti. Ture is the founder of the community organization We Are CR. He joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so tell us about how, I understand this house, this vacant house, is actually in your neighborhood, isn't it?
Yeah, about approximately 3 or 4 blocks away from my home.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn about the graffiti?
I'd had a breakfast meeting planned with the president of the Wellington Heights Neighborhood Association, and he sent it to me on his way to pick me up. He happened to drive past it, so he took a picture of it and sent it to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so You are African American. I don't know how diverse your neighborhood there in Cedar Rapids is. Are there many African Americans, non-white people?
Not exactly. No, there's not very many non-white people in my neighborhood. It's a predominantly white neighborhood. It has been slowly diversifying over time. However, it's still a small percentage of non-whites that live in the area.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? What were your thoughts when something like this happens?
My initial thought was, that's sad. Where is that? You know, and I was shocked to find out that it was here in town in Cedar Rapids, and even more so shocked once I found out how close it was to my home. There had been a lot of issues with the home, and it had been labeled a nuisance property, and I think that may have kind of played a role into whatever was going on over in that neighborhood.
In reading about this, it's a vandalized home, a rental property, vacant for months, and as you indicated, the sort of the center of problems in the neighborhood. Police often having to respond to complaints over the past year. So, are you telling me when you see this racist slur, this racist graffiti, you as a resident of the neighborhood, it doesn't reflect the attitudes in your neighborhood?
Most of the people on my block I've met, and they all seem like genuine people. I have not had any unpleasant interactions with anybody. I really don't think that the idea or attitude of the majority of the people in the neighborhood, I'm pretty sure that there may be one or two that statement reverberates through, but for the most part, I don't think that the entire neighborhood feels that way.
As I mentioned, you're the founder of an organization called We Are CR. What needs to happen in your view? What are you doing to improve the situation? I know you've been actively improving Cedar Rapids for a while now.
Well, right now we are working with the Cedar Rapids Police Department to investigate the matter. And once their investigation is done, then we'll know how to proceed. At this point, the action that we've come to as a group decide would be the best course of action is we put out a petition to have the landlord's rental license suspended for life. We feel like a tenant is going to be as good as their landlord. And from what we found out, he appears to be a slumlord, and we don't think that's something that's beneficial for Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about the goals of your organization. You're the founder of We Are CR.
The main goal of my organization is to pull the community together, give the community a sense of unity. And we work to do that through the election process. We feel like it's really important for us to come together as a community and find candidates who will represent us as a community and represent everybody in the community. So we get people to get involved in voting and knowing who candidates are. That's what we try to do. We try to get people to come together as a community and decide together who's going to represent us as a community.
Mm-hmm. Teray, may I ask how old you are?
I'm 46.
Mm-hmm. And you've lived in Cedar Rapids your whole life?
I've lived in Cedar Rapids since 1994.
Okay, that's quite a long time. I ask because I wonder if in that scope of time, if you can tell us if Cedar Rapids is getting better in terms of diversity and living together, the lessening of racist attitudes over the time that you've been there. What is the trend? Is it better than it was in the 90s or the early 2000s, or is it worse?
So initially, I would say that it's been better now than it was when I first got here. However, the protest last year would say otherwise. There was a lot of people who were doing back to blue and screaming "White Lives Matter," and it's a lot of work. It's hard work. It's discouraging and disheartening work. However, it's something that must be done, and so yeah, I won't shy away from doing it.
Well, it sounds like you're doing good work there in Cedar Rapids. Thank you for telling about this unfortunate incident, and keep up the good work. Ture Morrow is founder and organizer of We Are CR. Ture, have a good day. Have a good weekend. Thank you.
Thank you. You as well.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, when he was inaugurated back on January 20th, President Biden said he would have 100 million shots in the arms of Americans by his 100th day in office. Yesterday, 60-plus days into his administration, Biden announced he's doubling that goal, and indeed, the nation appears to be on track to meet 200 million shots in arms in the 100 days, already on track. As of yesterday, Thursday, the CDC reporting a total of 130 million shots had been administered, 14% of the American population fully vaccinated. Let's get an update on the vaccination campaign in our state from IPR health reporter Natalie Krebs. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Ben.
So the governor spoke again this week. She gave an update on the vaccination campaign. What did she have to say?
Right. So Governor Reynolds announced last week that, you know, due to the increase in vaccine allocation, the state was looking at opening up vaccine appointments to all eligible Iowans on April 5th. So this week during the governor's press conference on Wednesday, she basically affirmed that is the plan. They're still on track to be able to open up all vaccine appointments to all eligible Iowans. That's generally people 18 and older on April 5th.
Mm-hmm. So how should we think about that date? What are the messages perhaps the governor had for so many Iowans eagerly awaiting their shots? This will be really, April 5th will be like floodgates opening for people, and perhaps not to get expectations up too high that it's going to happen. You're going to have your vaccination on April 6th, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right, Ben. You know, we're going to see essentially what has been kind of a repeat of what we saw back February 1st when eligibility opened up to Iowans 65 or older, which is basically a lot of people really want this vaccine. Not a lot of appointments available. Governor Reynolds warned this week it's pretty much going to be the same thing. Just because vaccine appointments are opening up to all eligible Iowans on April 5th. Yeah, not everyone's going to have their appointment by April 6th. You know, people are going to be having to hunt all over for appointments. It's going to be a little bit before everyone who wants one can actually get in.
Mm-hmm. And this all depends on the federal government delivering the promised doses there. And so far, there has been, an uptick in the delivered doses as promised?
Yep, that's exactly it. And that's why the state is saying they're comfortable, on track for the April 5th opening up of the eligibility. They've mirrored other states around the country as well that are opening up their eligibility in the next week or two. And so basically, yeah, the state said they're expecting an increase next week, and they're expecting that allocation to increase even further in April.
Mm-hmm. What did I see in a statistic that Iowa is now up to in terms of Iowans with their first doses up over 25%, right?
Yeah, that number has definitely been increasing as well. We've seen numbers grow rapidly for Iowans who've been able to get their first dose. And like I said, we started out with about 19,000 doses a week. Governor Reynolds says next week we're up to about, 128,000 doses are expected.
That's quite a nice increase. This mm-hmm. week you looked into how vaccine information is getting out to non-English speakers in the state. Tell us a little bit about that and the challenges that you discovered in looking into that.
Yeah, so this is something I wanted to look into, which is just basically what resources were available to, you know, Iowans who don't speak English. This is a concern, you know, brought up by AARP. This is something that's been mentioned by the governor. And you know, what I found is there are some resources out there, you know, places like the Polk County Health Department, Johnson County Health Department have multilingual resources, but it can be really hard, especially, you know, Governor Reynolds' press conferences are available in English and Spanish. Those are where all the rapid updates are. And for people who don't speak those two languages, it can be really hard to stay on top of these rapidly changing weekly updates.
Mm-hmm. I saw in your reporting, it may surprise people, there are a lot of languages spoken in Iowa. I think you spoke with a resident of Polk County who is a native of Kenya, speaks Swahili.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different languages. You know, there's Swahili, there are Arabic speakers, there are people coming from Burma, and there are multiple different dialects of languages there. So there's a need for definitely resources to be in different languages.
Mm-hmm. One challenge is to get it translated, but also get the information to the immigrants or refugees who don't speak English. What did you find out about actually making sure their eyeballs get matched up with this translated information?
Yeah, right. So a lot of these groups that don't speak English are refugees. They've come over here from war-torn countries. And so there's sort of this cultural trust issue that you see. So, you know, a lot of times the state has done a lot. You know, they do offer translation resources, but it goes beyond just basically putting something out in Burmese or putting something out in Arabic and hoping that people will find it. There's definitely this need to kind of jump over these cultural barriers. And so, you know, some of the sources I talked to, you know, said the best way to really approach and get this information out is to use community leaders in this group to kind of get that COVID-19 information out, to be able to be the trusted source that can reach these communities.
Mm-hmm. And we have about a minute left, but just a reminder, as more and more Iowans do get vaccinated, now over 500,000 fully vaccinated, that doesn't mean you limit the social distancing, the safety that we've come to know from this pandemic. We can't just leave that behind, right?
Right. And, you know, it's been reported across the country. They've seen an uptick in cases and hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that a little bit in Iowa, too. So, again, it's just a reminder that the pandemic isn't over. There are a lot of unvaccinated Iowans still. You know, there's a limited supply. So it's really, really important that we just continue to follow physical distancing and really wear a mask wherever you go.
Natalie Krebs, our health reporter here at Iowa Public Radio. Natalie, thank you for the update.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, coming up after a short break on this News Buzz edition, IPR's Kate Payne tells us the latest about that, the investigation into the killing of two Anamosa State Penitentiary employees that happened earlier this week. Also, I'll talk with Cassidy Arena on how the state marked the first COVID death in Iowa 1 year ago, and on research into how COVID is impacting Iowa's Latino community differently. It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
The Iowa legislature is in session.
Let's just go around. We got a lot of people.
There are proposals for constitutional amendments, education, taxes, the budget, and many policy bills.
So what needs to be fixed?
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, is following the session.
I want to thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
I'm John Pemble. Subscribe to the podcast or hear Under the Golden Dome on our website, iowapublicradio.org.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this news week. Well, it's believed to be the first time in decades that an Iowa prison staff member has been killed by an inmate. Tuesday of this week, an Anamosa State Penitentiary nurse and a correctional officer were killed by inmates, apparently attempting to escape. On Wednesday, IPR's Kate Payne attended a news conference outside of the Anamosa prison. She joins me now. Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Well, this is terrible. Tell us more about the chain of events as they are understood now that led to these deaths within the prison.
Yes. So what we understand from state investigators is that Tuesday morning, two incarcerated individuals, Thomas Woodard and Michael Bucher, were staging an escape attempt at the Anamosa prison. They got a hold of two hammers and a grinder that were thought to come from the prison maintenance shop, and they were able to get inside of a staff break room that's inside of the infirmary at the prison under the ruse of repairing some equipment there. And they broke through a glass window and were trying to grind through the metal bars to the outside. And investigators say that they used the hammers to beat a nurse, Lorena Schulte, and a correctional officer, Robert McFarland, in the head. And both of those staff died of severe blunt force head injuries. And officials say that the inmates also grabbed another employee who survived the incident, and that they beat another inmate who was apparently trying to help the injured.
Hmm. Must have been obviously a horrible scene there and traumatizing for the state, but especially for the community of Anamosa, a longtime home to this state penitentiary. Tell us more about the atmosphere at the press conference and what you learned there.
It was a pretty striking scene there for folks who maybe haven't seen the prison itself. It is a fortress. It's this huge limestone fortress, really in the center of this community. And it is a major employer, a regional employer, an institution where many folks spend 30 years of their lives working for the department. And we saw many of them come out as a show of support for the victims on the day of this press conference. I counted, 60-some people, apart from the journalists who came just to listen, and some had brought flowers, balloons, cards to sort of lay at the steps of the prison and just to hear what had happened, the horrific details that state investigators told us. And I heard, from multiple former employees that they consider, their fellow coworkers family. Even after they retire, there's an incredible camaraderie among some of these folks. And just the horrific actions that we're hearing that happened to this nurse and this correctional officer, it's really shaken a lot of people.
Yeah. Yesterday, that press conference on Wednesday outside of the prison in Anamosa. Yesterday, Thursday, some further developments. What happened there?
Yeah, so the two incarcerated individuals have been transferred to the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison. They also made their first appearance in court, and they're being held without bond.
What more can you tell us about the victims while respecting their families' right to privacy?
Yes, and that is what we've heard, is that the families do need time to mourn, of course, this incredible, shocking loss. But what we know is that Lorena Schulte, the nurse, was 50 years old, and the correctional officer, Robert McFarland, was 46. Both had worked at Anamosa for more than a decade, and both were from Linn County. Schulte lived in Cedar Rapids and was an aunt, a gardener. She had previously worked at the Iowa Veterans Home, and McFarland lived in Ely, and he had a wife and three children, and he worked as a volunteer for the Ely Fire Department. And former employees told me that they were both just good people, kind people, and it's just a horrific way to go.
Yeah, it sure is. And anything more you can tell us about the two suspects, the inmates, Michael Dutcher, Thomas Woodard, charged with first-degree murder. What about their backgrounds?
So Dutcher is 28 and Woodard is 39. They had both been serving time on first-degree robbery charges, among other counts. Both had been in the Woodbury County area when they were committed to Anamosa. Dutcher had been involved in robbing motels and a bank, and Woodard was involved with a home break-in.
Mm-hmm. As this investigation continues in the days and weeks to come, what what are apparent to you as the key questions being raised as these murders are investigated?
Well, certainly questions are still there as far as, you know, how exactly did they get a hold of these tools, and how were they able to get into this break room and sort of move throughout the facility. And we did hear some from state investigators at the press conference. They believe that the tools came from the maintenance shop, and the warden, Jeremy Larson, also told us that Officer McFarland was supervising the inmates at the time of the incident. And there are a host of policies and procedures at the prison as far as how inmates are able to access tools. We understand that these two individuals were maintenance workers at the prison, and so they would have had some access to the maintenance shop and to the tools there. With different levels of supervision for different kinds of tools. I spoke with a retired Anamosa maintenance employee, Brian Nassif, who worked there for more than 30 years. And he was saying that during his time, a grinder would have been an escort tool. So a staffer would have had to be with them at all times. But a hammer, he said, during his time was a non-escort tool. You could just sort of check it out and go about your job, go about your day. So there is still an internal review happening as far as whether those policies were all followed and just how the inmates were able to go about this.
Right. And also for years, I know in covering, having visited several prisons in the state myself, reported from them, also know that there have been longstanding chronic understaffing concerns of our correctional facilities. Well, that will enter or already has entered the conversation, I imagine.
Absolutely. So advocates, the union asked me, Council 61, current and former employees, you know, just keep saying that there aren't enough staff, that they need more correctional officers, more people to supervise. You know, we spoke with a number of former employees who have spent 30 years at Anamosa, and they talk about how much smaller the inmate population was when they started, how many more officers there were, and how that's just reversed due to state budget cuts. Like so many agencies, the DOC took a serious hit after the Great Recession, and state lawmakers have never really restored it to what it was.
Clearly, in the weeks to come, a lot of mourning for the deaths of these two individuals and a lot of stock-taking as the investigation continues into the death of two staff members, an Anamosa State Penitentiary nurse and a correctional officer, killed evidently by inmates attempting to escape. IPR's Kate Payne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, we'll groove into the weekend with IPR Studio One host Cece Mitchell. First, let's check in with IPR's Cassidy Arena at this week's end. Cassidy, hi. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Well, thank you for being on. Let's talk about a couple of the things you covered this week. We marked this week the death of the first Iowan from the COVID virus. Since then, more than 5,000 Iowans have died of complications from the virus. There was a remembrance this week of those who have died in the past year due to COVID. Tell us about it.
Yeah, exactly. So this past Wednesday did mark the anniversary of the first Iowan who died of COVID-19. And like you said, you know, we've had thousands of other Iowans also pass away. So basically what happened was just kind of, you know, people who were speaking there did acknowledge, you know, this is the very least amount that we can do in order to remember those who have been lost from COVID-19. So a group of a mixture of lawmakers, state lawmakers, and other organization leaders from nonprofits, et cetera, met in front of the state capitol literally just to read out those names and to provide some sort of solace for families who have lost family members or family friends. And A few speakers, actually, one state senator actually was speaking and listed the name of her own family friend who passed away. So it was a really sad experience, but mm-hmm. also, you know, it was one way to also heal from this crazy year that we've had.
Right. And I understand not all 5,000 plus names were read aloud, right? And there's an invitation for those listening, perhaps, who have lost a loved one to use a virtual memorial?
Yes. So in order to have all, you know, more than 5,500 names listed, that would have taken quite a while. So the volunteers did read a selection of around 700 names. In the meantime, they did encourage anybody who has lost a loved one to go ahead and go to iowacovidmemorial.org. It's an ongoing virtual memorial for all Iowans who have passed away due to COVID-19.
Okay, iowacovidmemorial.org, if you'd like to remember someone in your life who has passed away this past year since the first death of an Iowan due to the COVID virus. Cassidy, mm-hmm. you reported this week on a new research being launched into how Latinos have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19, both in terms of physical and psychological terms. Tell us about what's taking place.
Yeah, so some University of Iowa researchers, PhD students, are trying to find any sort of data that they can about the long-term effects of COVID-19 on Latino households in Iowa. So this is something that a few groups in the past have kind of dipped their toe into trying to figure it out, because we know on a national level that Latinos and Black and Asian members of our society have been disproportionately affected. But now we also want to find out on, you know, under a microscope, what's going on specifically in Iowa. And a few groups have tried in the past, and they sort of hit roadblocks, and they're kind of on pause. And so when I asked these two researchers if this was something that they thought was possibly in their future, they responded, you know, quite confidently that disappearing isn't really an option for them. They need to find out what these long-term effects are and how we can kind of avoid the disproportionate effect Latinos have in public health crises in the future. So, you know, they've sent out surveys to randomly selected households in a few counties in Iowa that are highly populated by Latinos or Hispanic people, and that's how they're going to go forward with their analysis.
Okay, any indication from them how they expect their findings sometime to be used?
Yeah, they actually just told me that they are receiving a few feedback as of right now in Spanish and English. The surveys are bilingual. And so as of right now, you know, they do expect people to say that it's been a hard time. It's been not only a hard time psychologically, physically, economically. And so what they're hoping to do is take that data and then tell people, okay, how can we solve this problem? Or how can we avoid this problem in the future? And, you know, as of right now, it's just kind of a waiting game as they tally up the responses.
Mm-hmm. And finally, before we say goodbye to you, Cassidy, this week, recently, word of an expected increase of refugees and immigrants into our state. To tell us what's expected and why.
Yeah, so President Joe Biden, when he was elected earlier this year, he did say that he does expect to increase the refugee gap or cap that is allowed in the United States. So what one might think is, why on earth would somebody be coming to Iowa? You know, we're in the middle of the country. We're not really that close to any other places where we would possibly get refugees. But here's the thing. Iowa, when I was speaking to the Des Moines field office for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, they kind of said, you know what, Iowa's a great place for refugees to come. It's affordable to live. There are jobs. There's good schools. So knowing that about Iowa itself, the Des Moines field office is expecting, once President Biden does go forth with increasing that cap, more refugees, and with that, they're looking for more donations, especially for households, because basically what they're going to do is help those refugees resettle and find a comfortable life here in Iowa.
Right. And that those monies that would be raised will go for very basic things, right, that every household needs.
Yeah, exactly. As basic as a mattress. That's the most important thing that they're trying to raise right now, because for many of these people coming, the director, Carrie Trufunk, told me for many of these people coming to Iowa, this will be the very first mattress that they can call their own. So it's something that some people may look over as just an everyday item. But, mm-hmm. you know, for some people first coming to Iowa, it means a lot to them.
Right. And refugees coming from really dire situations from all parts of the world. And it's great that we can show our compassion, open our doors to those people who deserve some humanitarian help as refugees. Cassidy Arena, thank you so much for the update. You have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River, let's groove into the weekend. CeCe Mitchell joins me now, IPR Studio One Tracks host, along with her colleagues, Tony Daner and Mark Simmet. CeCe, hi, welcome.
Hi, Ben. Great to hear from you.
I hope the week is ending well for you. I know Studio One goes well into the weekend, as does News 2 as well. We have workers on the weekend. We work during the week, but we like to have you ease us out of a news week that was. What do you have?
So I've got two tracks for you today. The first one is by this guy. His name is Adam Melcher. He used to be a guitarist for this indie band called Francis Cone, but for the past 4 years, he's been going solo and making like acoustic indie singer-songwriter stuff. He's released a lot of singles. I think the first one was in 2017. But this new record of his, it's called Melcher Lullaby Hotline Volume 1, kind of a wordy one. It's his debut full-length record. So I Googled this guy because I just listened to one of the singles. But when I Googled him, not a lot came up. I think he's pretty much just got hit digitally from like small indie music news outlets. But he's getting really popular on Spotify. So with his new debut record, I think we're going to be hearing a lot more from him. Somebody to keep an ear out for. It's Adam Melcher, and this is a track from his new record, Begin Again.
And I'm not too proud to say I cried. Even as the bleeding stopped, it hit me all at once. 'Cause I know.
Well, Adam Melcher certainly has me tapping my foot, CeCe Mitchell. Begin Again from that new album, Melcher Lullaby Hotline Volume 1. Nice selection. What's another one you can groove us into the weekend with?
So with the weather getting better, I've been listening to a lot of stuff like Adam Melcher that's just really like fun and light and springtimey. So our next track is like that as well. It's by the band Group Love. You might recognize that name because they had a really popular hit on Top 40 a few years back called Tongue Tied. But now they've released a new surprise album. I really love when artists release surprise albums. It's so fun. The new album's called This Is This. It's very upbeat and summery, like I said. Really perfect for this time of year, and it's got that like quintessential indie pop sound that's always a crowd pleaser. So this track is called Just What You Want, a new one by Group Love.
All my life I wanted to be better, but there's something about my middle finger and my all that baby. Oh, bad baby. Remember when I called you?
I can remember. Looking back, I did it for the danger.
Now that's a tune with attitude, Cece, I'd have to say. Springtime, yes. Bouncy, yes. But some attitude in there, too. Thank you so much for grooving us into the weekend, Cece Mitchell, Studio One Tracks host. Your best new music and old favorites, courtesy of Tony, Cece, and Mark. Have a great weekend, Cece. Thank you. We'll go out with this tune.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you. And that's it for this edition of River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez. Help also from Jonathan Free. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.